And joining me on the phone to talk about Afghanistan today is Sonali Kolhatkar. Sonali Kolhatkar is the host and producer of KPFA's popular morning program, Uprising, based in Los Angeles, California. She is also the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, a U.S.-based nonprofit solidarity organization that funds the social, political, and humanitarian projects of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She is the co-author of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence, which is being released next week. Hello, Sonali, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. Really appreciate it. Maybe we could start off, if you could give us some details about the book that's coming out next week.
Sure. We're very excited about this book. My partner, Jim Ingalls, who's also my co-author on this book, we've been working together for several years now in preparation for it. Last February, we traveled to Afghanistan and spent several weeks there documenting the ongoing human rights problems, interviewing dozens of people from government officials to foreign peacekeepers, to students and refugees and teachers and journalists in Afghanistan, and really trying to get a sense from them of what they wanted in their country, what their opinion was of U.S. policy, etc. And when we came back, we put that all together along with research that we'd been doing for several years here in the United States, and put together a book that we hope fills a void on progressive analysis of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. There's a lot of books about Iraq, a lot of books about Palestine, but there's so few books, if any, about Afghanistan, particularly from a progressive perspective, particularly from a perspective that's critical of U.S. foreign policy. And that was the void that we hoped this book would fill. So we give a historical sketch of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan from the 70s onwards through till 2001, and then really looking at post 9/11 policies of installing a puppet government in Afghanistan, of really kind of bringing back fundamentalism in Afghanistan, and of the bombing campaign that took place in late 2001, etc. And then we also take a very deep look at the way in which women were used to justify the war, how many well-meaning women here in the United States supported the U.S. war in Afghanistan, thinking that the war would actually liberate Afghan women from the Taliban. And we criticize not only the Bush administration for using this very cynical ploy, but also liberal feminists for exploiting Afghan women. We also take a very deep look at media analysis and look at how the media, the United States media, has played a role in really kind of putting forward the government position on Afghanistan, not covering Afghanistan when it's convenient and covering it when it is convenient again. And then we take a look at the uses of Afghanistan by the United States, meaning what are the interests of the U.S. there, what are the goals and motivations. And finally, our epilogue really tries to challenge activists here in the United States to take a good long look at why it is that we don't include Afghanistan in our activism, and we make several recommendations about what we think U.S. activists should do. So that's basically a sketch of the entire book, and we really hope your listeners will get a chance to check the book out. We're donating all the author royalties to RAWA, by the way, because we really feel that their work is so crucial in the rebuilding of that country.
Maybe at the end we can talk about some of your recommendations about what U.S. activists should or could be doing differently or more of. Anyway, that book that we've been talking about is Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence, which is being released next week. It's co-authored by my guest on the phone, Sonali Kolhatkar, and James Ingalls. Both of them also are co-directors of the Afghan Women's Mission, which supports the work of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And as you heard just now from Sonali, the royalties from the sales of the book will go to support that group, RAWA. So right around the 5th anniversary of September 11th now, do you have any thoughts about 5 years later just how that attack was used as justification for invading Afghanistan and the aftermath of that.
This is a very significant anniversary from so many different perspectives, and we're being inundated in the media with all sorts of aspects of that. But what I think of when we're approaching this anniversary is the fact that those who died on September 11, 2001 in the United States and those who died in Afghanistan both before and after September 11th as a result of U.S. policy were all victims of a vicious policy that was started by the U.S. government with previous administrations, actually the Carter administration on through the Reagan years, even Clinton, and now George W. Bush. These policies and really the religious fundamentalist policies that then were fueled as a result. And I really look at the American and Afghan victims as victims of the same thing. Different actions, but the same phenomenon. I think that both peoples of both countries, although to completely different degrees, are suffering, have suffered, and probably will be suffering the twin evils of Western imperialism and religious fundamentalism. One encourages the other, one creates or leads to the other, but I think Western imperialism probably came about before the religious fundamentalism in this case. And now we're seeing a situation where it's spiraling completely out of control. It's very significant that on the fifth anniversary of 9/11, that Afghanistan is once again in the news, and the Taliban are resurging. One European think tank claims that the Taliban are now in control of half the country, the southern half of the country, and that's enormous. What has the United States been doing there for these past 5 years? And so, those are some of the things that are going through my head in this anniversary.
One of the justifications for the war, not initially against Afghanistan, but once it was underway, was that we were going to liberate Afghan women. What are your thoughts on that 5 years after that?
Well, the Taliban came into power in the late 90s, a lot of women here in the United States, women activists, began pointing to the horrific misogynist policies of the Taliban. But by and large, the mainstream in the United States did not really know what was going on. When we came sort of close to, particularly in the year 2001, the Taliban's ugly policies towards women were starting to see more light. And of course, when 9/11 happened, it all became very exposed. It was as though the world was seeing for the first time something that had been going on under their very noses for the past 4 or 5 years. And in fact, even for the past decade and a half, if you really look back at how women's rights had been really made subservient to other issues and really been attacked by the proteges of U.S. policy who went before the Taliban. These were the Mujahideen or the Northern Alliance. And all of this became suddenly apparent, almost overnight, it seemed, to the rest of the world, and particularly Americans. And, when it became clear that the United States was going to attack Afghanistan, it also became very clear that the Bush administration, particularly under the advisement of Karen Hughes, their then presidential advisor, saw in the oppression of Afghan women a perfect opportunity to justify a war on Afghanistan. First of all, who was going to go support the Taliban? Who in the world was going to come to the aid of the Taliban or defend the Taliban? They were a horrific misogynist regime. They were a perfect target. And then on top of that, if you could show how women, or you could convince Americans that women would be freed once the Taliban were toppled, you really got a lot more support. A lot of liberals supported this war, and it was very, very disheartening. Because for anybody who had studied U.S. foreign policy over the past decade and a half, whether in Afghanistan or otherwise, anybody who is a student of U.S. policy and who really looks at critically at U.S. policy knows that the U.S. never goes into a conflict with human rights at its core or human rights as its goal. It always goes in for its own interests. And we knew that it was a cynical ploy aimed at just using Afghan women. And when the war was being fought, the media complied a very, very very useful way to the Bush administration. You had all of these images of Afghan women in the burqa, which is a traditional conservative garment that women have been wearing for many, many years in Afghanistan. But it became very famous because the Taliban were forcing all women to wear them, and the media, constantly portrayed Afghan women in these burqas. And the idea that was implied throughout all of this was that once the Taliban were defeated, Afghan women, whose oppression was now symbolized by this one garment, would be freed as soon as their burqas were lifted. And once the Taliban fell, of course, the laws on forced veiling were removed, and the media went around exposing, women's faces on the pages of our newspapers so that we were all convinced that Afghan women were freed, they were liberated, but it was not that simple. Afghan women's oppression was far beyond one single item of clothing. And what we've seen in the years following is that they continue to suffer. They continue to have problems accessing education and healthcare, and they've continued to be abandoned by the international community. People in this country think that we saved Afghan women somehow. That's not true. It's true that there are a few freedoms that are available to them, but it's still true that most Afghan women live to the age of 45, are likely to die during childbirth, have no access to health care or education outside of certain cities. And so I think those are very important things to think about when we look at the issue of women's liberation in Afghanistan.
What is the current political situation in Afghanistan? I heard that the Taliban, there's been a resurgence and that they are currently at their strongest point since before the U.S. invaded. I've also heard that it's pretty chaotic, that there's a lot of warlords controlling different chunks of the country and fighting amongst each other. What is the situation as you understand it?
I think the way you described it is pretty accurate. The Taliban are really, in the southern half of the country, have really regained a lot of power. And you can really trace that. I think the important point to understand here for your listeners is that the U.S. policy has really helped create the situation. The Taliban were always fairly strong in the southern half of the country, particularly in the southern province of Kandahar. And for the last 5 years, the United States has been carrying out this hunt and kill policy. And this approach to fighting terrorism that involves chasing finite number of men who they claim are Taliban and Al Qaeda, hunting them down and killing them, and that includes going down, entering communities and kicking down doors, rounding up people, detaining them, torturing them, in some cases killing them, really becoming extremely unpopular in a country which actually, was fairly hopeful that the United States might actually help this time. And so these policies have actually strengthened the Taliban, because then the Taliban are able to point to the ordinary Afghans, look at how brutal this enemy is. Look at how brutal the United States is. The United States never really cared about you. And what's really interesting is that the Taliban are actually now providing social services in some areas to Afghan people. The Afghan people are an extremely poor people. They're among the most hungry people in the world. They are, among the most unhealthy in terms of the health care. They have the worst health care almost in the whole world. If you look at the way the United Nations has ranked their health and well-being and access to education, et cetera, they rank 173 out of 178, according to the United Nations Development Index. And the Taliban are providing social services that the West has failed to provide. And so they are now gaining popularity in Afghanistan. On the one hand, they see the U.S. being this brutal, heavy-handed, imperial foreign force in their country. And on the other hand, they see the Taliban providing some measure in some areas of some social services. And so you're seeing the Taliban gain a lot of power, gain more recruits, and the United States getting more and more unpopular. That's in the southern part of the country. In the northern part of the country, and this is sort of a pretty generalized statement, it's not exactly that clean, but this is, for the most part, in the northern part of the country, the U.S.'s former proteges, the Mujahideen warriors, the Northern Alliance, regional and local commanders and warlords, were brought back into power after 2001 because they helped the U.S. defeat the Taliban. And these men have gained their fiefdoms in the northern part of the country. They have now once more become drug producers as they used to be, and they have really begun resuming their oppressive policies against the Afghan people. These were the men who plunged Afghanistan into a bloody civil war in the early 1990s and destroyed Kabul, killing tens of thousands of people. They're very unpopular. They're out for power and for their own interests. And unfortunately, there are also many of them members of the current Afghan parliament. They basically bullied their way onto the parliament, and so they have a lot of political power. So they kind of control the central government and the political power in Kabul, as well as large swaths of the countryside in the northern part of the country. And that's basically, you know, who the Afghan people are caught between. The Afghan people, the ordinary people, are caught between the Taliban, the Northern Alliance, as well as U.S. and NATO forces, and they're being squeezed from all sides. And we really have to sort of wonder how it is that they've been able to survive so long.
So would you say that generally speaking, things are worse or about the same or somewhat better than they were before the U.S. invaded?
I think there, you know, it's a complex question. I don't think I can make a sort of a flat statement. In some respects, things are better, and I think that really must be admitted, you know, whether we like it or not. The most important thing is that the Taliban's legalized oppression of women is over. You know, the Taliban instituted into law what was essentially being practiced in a chaotic and unorganized manner by their predecessors, the U.S.-backed fundamentalists. And the Taliban came in and they instituted women's oppression into law and legalized their lack of access to healthcare, education, et cetera, employment, et cetera. That being lifted is a very good thing. Those legal barriers to women are now gone. Now, on a practical level, of course, things are quite different. Another very good thing is that Afghanistan does have a parliament and a constitution. The caveat being that the constitution has a statement that makes the Sharia law, Islamic law that the Taliban used, as the supreme law of the land. This was sort of an appeasement, a way to appease the warlords. Still, there are many aspects of the constitution that are fairly progressive. In fact, the Constitution states right up front that all men and women are equal, something that even our own Constitution here in the U.S. doesn't have. And there are quotas for women in the parliament. You know, there are minimum numbers of seats that women are set aside for women in the Afghan parliament. This is a very good thing. And there are some women in the parliament, one of whom in particular has been speaking out very loudly, an amazing young woman named Malalai Joya. Maybe your listeners have heard of her, who has been speaking out against the U.S.-backed warlords. So those are some of the good things. And in cities like Kabul, security has improved. Education, there's better access to education and employment and healthcare. Now, on the other hand, outside of Kabul, things are pretty much the same as before, and in some cases, they are worse than before. Domestic violence and sexual violence against women, for example, has really skyrocketed. Dozens of women have been self-immolating in the western part of the country, meaning they're burning themselves to death. It's a phenomenon that was not even seen under the Taliban. The Taliban making the issue of drug production, is also something that was worse than before. Drug production had sort of become a little bit under control under the Taliban, but after the fall of the Taliban, Afghanistan is once more the highest drug-producing country in the world. So on the one hand, certain things, at least on paper, have gotten better, and in theory have gotten better, and many things are still the same. A few things have gotten much worse.
We only have a few minutes left. I have a couple more questions for you, though, and I want to get to them. There has been some recent studies released from some think tanks about the situation. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Senlis Council and one other think tank in Europe. These are international think tanks based in Europe, have released a couple of reports on Afghanistan just last week, actually. And, you know, these are sort of mainstream to conservative think tanks. They're not liberal. They're not, like, radical or anything. And what they have found, especially the Senlis Council report, which you can find on the internet if you do a search for Senlis Council, that's spelled S-E-N-L-I-S. What they found was that basically the policies of the West, so the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, have directly led to continued and increased instability in Afghanistan, and really to the resurgence of the Taliban. They have said the Taliban are back. The Taliban are now controlling the southern half of the country. The narcotics production is at an all-time high. Some of the very same things that I've been saying during this interview have been really set forth by this interesting report. Now, they come at it from the perspective of the U.S. war in Afghanistan being justified, and you know that good could have come out of this. Even from that perspective, they say things have gotten so bad, and you can trace all of the bad things to Western policy. You know, and that is, I think, an extremely significant thing. So I really encourage your listeners to check that report out.
Tell me the name again of it.
It's a report by the Senlis Council, S-E-N-L-I-S, Senlis Council based in Europe.
S-E-N-L-I-S,
yes.
Senlis Council. Great. So my final question is, the beginning when you were describing your book, you say that in the book, and again, that book is coming out next week, it is called Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence, and is co-authored by my guest on the phone, Sonali Kolhatkar and James Ingalls. You say that in the book you talk about things that U.S. activists can do and should be doing. Can you, my final question will be, what can folks here do? And maybe you can give out some places they can go for more information at the same time that you answer that.
Absolutely, and I really appreciate you asking this question. This is, I think, probably the most important thing. You know, your listeners who consider themselves anti-war activists, really, I think one of the basic things you can do is to remember Afghanistan. I can't tell you how many events I've been to, demonstrations, rallies, you know, community forums, etc., where people talk about the war on terror, and they're referring only to Iraq, and we never hear about Afghanistan. Even in our own alternative media, we so rarely hear about Afghanistan. And I really challenge your listeners to try to include Afghanistan when you're talking about injustices and U.S. foreign policy, because Afghanistan is a country that has suffered just as much as the Iraqis have, and they are still being attacked. They still have the presence of U.S. forces on their soil, and the policies of U.S. You know, have had so many repercussions. So really remember Afghanistan. Another thing you know, that I recommend is that, you know, what should we be asking from our U.S. government? Should it be a simple thing such as troops out now that a lot of the people working on Iraq have suggested? I think it's a little more complex than that, because if you look at surveys that have been done with the Afghan people, for the most part, at least up until recently, had been saying that they would like the presence of foreign troops in their country. That's not that they like foreign presence in their country. It just means that they like the Taliban less than they like the United States. And they want some sort of peacekeeping forces in their country to help these states. They just want an end to war, and they want some sort of peacekeeping international force between the Taliban and them, between the warlords, the Northern Alliance, and them. They hate these fundamentalists, and they want they need some help. And so I don't think it's as simple as get the troops out now. But what can the U.S. do to try to create a situation where Afghan people didn't want troops or need troops? The U.S. could ask for complete and absolute disarmament. There is a U.N. program right now that is funding disarmament in Afghanistan. It's called DDR, Disarmament, Demobilization, Reintegration, and it's not being fully funded. In fact, Japan is, I think, funding most of it. American people should be asking our government to fully fund that. After all, these were the arms given to the fundamentalists by our government and paid for by our tax dollars. The least we can do is take them out of the country. And surveys have shown that Afghan people, the majority of them, want disarmament. Another thing we need to do is think about reparations to this country. It is a poor, starving country that essentially won the Cold War for us. We won the Cold War on the backs of the Afghan people, and they are suffering tremendously. They're starving to death, and they deserve real reconstruction, Afghan-led reconstruction projects, real important healthcare, educational projects. If you look at post-conflict situations in the world, such as Kosovo and East Timor, and you see how much money was spent per capita in those conflicts, that's much, much more than what was spent in Afghanistan. So, you know, strings-free reparations, grants, aid, etc., really needs to come from the U.S. government to the Afghan people. And once the situation has been stabilized, once the Taliban have no power and the Northern Alliance have no power, then the troops need to get out and get out fast. Peacekeepers are still needed in Afghanistan, but they should come from countries that have never had their hands in Afghanistan. Countries excluding Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the U.S., Russia, etc. Because the Afghan people need peacekeepers, but they should be disinterested peacekeepers. So there's a number of recommendations, and maybe your listeners can check out the epilogue to our book for some details on that. And also, finally, the listeners should consider supporting RAWA, this organization of women that is both anti-fundamentalist and anti-imperialist, who want a secular democracy based on women's rights and human rights. You can find out more about RAWA at rawa.org. That's RAWA.org. You can donate to RAWA's projects through our website, AfghanWomen'sMission.org. And that's AfghanWomen'sMission.org. We take tax-deductible donations for all of RAWA's social and political projects. So really, really do check that out and pass it on. You can join our monthly pledge program and make monthly donations. And then if you want to learn more about Afghanistan, I hope you check our book out. As I mentioned, all proceeds benefit RAWA. And the book's website is bleedingafghanistan.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sonali. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it as well. And thanks for paying attention to Afghanistan.
Of course. We'll hopefully have you on again in the future.
I'd like that.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
You too.
Again, that was Sonali Kolhatkar. She is the host and producer of KPFK's popular morning program, Uprising, based in Los Angeles, California. She's also the co-director of Afghan Women's Mission, a U.S.-based nonprofit solidarity organization that funds the social, political, and humanitarian projects of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She is also the co-author of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence, which is being released next week. To check out RAWA's website, just go to rawa.org. To check out Afghan Women's Mission, just go to AfghanWomen'sMission.org. And to learn more about the book, go to BleedingAfghanistan.com. You're listening to Peace Talks on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.